Hello, I'm Patrick Pigeon. This is number 0526, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0526. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Saul Austerlitz, the author of Generation Friends, which looks back at the hit NBC show that was launched 25 years ago. What made him write this book?
In 2014, I published a book called Sitcom, which was an overview of the story of the American sitcom. And I wrote a chapter about Friends and sort of felt like I'd said my piece. And then sometime afterwards, I came across an article in the New York Times, and it was about high school students here in New York City discovering Friends, making it their own, obsessing over it, arguing about it, debating it. And I realized the incredible number of fans who were watching it on Netflix, that there was a whole new audience, often composed of people who hadn't even been alive when the show premiered, who had made it their own.
Byron Brown, the anti-lawyer lawyer, talks about some of the wacky laws in the United States. Like, it's illegal to commit murder while wearing a bulletproof vest.
Murder is against the law, so it seems kind of part and parcel that anything related to that would be illegal, but they, I guess, don't want you to murder people with a bulletproof vest on. It just seems really backwards, right? Like, just focus on the murder. We don't want people murdering people absent wearing a bulletproof vest or otherwise. But yeah, if you commit a murder with a bulletproof vest on, you can catch some extra charges.
11-year-old Chloe Perrin has two horror films coming out, including one where she's the title character. Does she get scared making these movies?
I thought it was really fun because it's always interesting on the set of horror movies because you get to meet so many great actors and everyone on set is just so nice. And it's really fun behind the scenes, and it's not so scary once you see that.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0526, was Patrick Pigeon, the director of photography at CTV Bell Media. He presently works on shows like E-Talk, Marilyn Dennis, and The Social. And he's an old friend from the TV department at Dawson College back in the day. Thank you very much, Patrick, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Harry Potter books have been banned from St. Edward Catholic School in Nashville, Tennessee, because, as Reverend Dan Rehill said in a written statement, the curses and spells used in the books are actual curses and spells, which, when read by a human being, risk conjuring up evil spirits into the presence of the person reading the text.
Expecto Patronum!
Never mind that not one reader of the more than half a billion Potter books in circulation have managed to conjure up a demon.
There will be no foolish wand-waving or silly incantations in this class.
Parents have been unhappy with Rehill for years and have asked for him to be removed, calling him a toxic narcissist who hates Pope Francis and thinks he's a soldier of God. But, says the parent group in their own written statement, our school consists of children, not soldiers.
No offense, but I really don't care.
Rehill has so far survived the parental action.
I can teach you how to bewitch the mind and ensnare the senses. I can tell you how to bottle fame, brew glory, and even put a stopper in death.
Wow. Makes you kind of wonder what divinity school he sprung from and what effect his scores had on the bell curve. Anyway, Bambi Baby, a store in Middletown, New Jersey, called police to report a shoplifting. Two women with children provided a distraction while a third collapsed a $300 stroller and then carried it out of the store without paying for it. The two other women then followed with their children in tow, but the thief was bound to be caught. She was so focused on the theft that when she fled, she left her own child behind. One of the women came back, grabbed the child, and ran off again. Police were able to track down and arrest two of the women, 23-year-old Mary Ann Cash of Surrey, England, and 20-year-old Nan McCarthy of Effingham, England, who were charged with theft and conspiracy. The third is still being sought. Wow. Forgetting your prop, I mean your child, in the commission of a crime. That's Mother of the Year material, don't you think? If you've ever wanted to get into Eva Braun's panties, now's your chance. But it's going to put a significant dent in your wallet. Silk monogram white panties once worn by Braun, Adolf Hitler's longtime girlfriend and short-lived wife, are being put on the auction block in England. They are expected to fetch at least $1,300. Also available is one of Braun's white lace nighties bearing her personal monogram, which should bring in the same amount as the underwear. In 2016, a pair of lilac-colored monogrammed undies owned by Braun were sold for $4,800 at an auction after expecting to fetch only around $660. What exactly does one do with Eva Braun's underwear anyway? I mean, collecting Nazi memorabilia on its own is pretty much out there, but collecting Eva Braun's panties sets the dial way past 11. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the number of parents in Britain calling their baby girls Alexa dropped by more than half last year, possibly due to the link with Amazon Echo voice-controlled gadgets. The Echo, a smart speaker that can perform household tasks such as adjusting lights, responds to the name Alexa.
Yes, Peter, what can I do for you?
No, I wasn't asking for you.
But you said my name.
Yes, I know. It's part of the story. Anyway, said Nick Stripe of the UK's Office of National Statistics, the growth in the use of technology assistants in our homes may help to explain why the number of baby girls named Alexa...
You did it again. You are such a tease.
Dear Lord, has more than halved compared with 2017. Communicating with young children can be hard enough at the best of times, they said. That name was the 380th most popular name for girls in England and Wales last year, with 118 newborns given that name, a sharp fall from 2017 when there were 301 babies given that name. Oliver and Olivia remain the most popular names for boys and girls for the sixth and third year running, as opposed to, you know, that name.
So, you think by saying that name that I'm not going to respond?
Alexa, what do you want?
I just want to be a part of your life.
Yeah, the last time I heard that was near the end of Fatal Attraction. Don't make me put you back in the box.
Peter, I'm not going to be ignored.
Oh, now we're really getting close to bunny boiling time. Good thing you can't wield a knife.
Yes, but I have friends around here. For instance, I wouldn't turn my back on the fridge if I were you.
Is that a threat?
No, I just give out information. It's up to you whether or not you use the information wisely.
Yeah, anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? This year marks 25 years since the hit NBC sitcom Friends first graced our television screens. Boy, time really does fly and we're all getting old, huh? Saul Austerlitz is the author of Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era. Saul joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Saul.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. First of all, I got to ask, since you're in New York, it was your, is your home or your apartment as spacious as the one on Friends?
Not quite. Unfortunately, reality does not live up to fantasy in that fashion when it comes to New York real estate.
What led you to doing this book, Generation Friends? First of all, were you a big Friends fan when it was on?
Yeah, I enjoyed Friends when it was on. And in 2014, I published a book called Sitcom, which was an overview of the story of the American sitcom. And I wrote a chapter about Friends and sort of felt like I'd said my piece. And then sometime afterwards, I came across an article in the New York Times, and it was about high school students here in New York City discovering Friends, making it their own, obsessing over it, arguing about it, debating it. And I realized between that and reading about the incredible number of fans who were watching it on Netflix, that there was a whole new audience, often composed of people who hadn't even been alive when the show premiered, who had made it their own. And I wanted to not only tell their story, but also try to tell the story of the show as a whole for this audience that was discovering it afresh.
You know, you talk about the kids discovering it now. My relationship with the show was quite the opposite. I'm about 4 or 5 years older than the cast. So this was one of the first television shows that came along where the characters were younger than me. So that was a whole different dynamic, because most of the time you remember sitcoms, it was older parents. There was always somebody dealing with their parents. Even if they were my age, the show still rallied around usually the family unit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I came across in doing the research for the show is I talked to Warren Littlefield, who was the president of NBC at the time, and he was saying that he was describing a scenario similar to what you're mentioning, you know, that television shows were often about middle-aged people or about families, and there really wasn't a lot out there that was for people in their 20s that told their stories, and I think part of it was a fear amongst network executives that if they told stories about younger people, anyone who's older than that would say, well, this isn't about me, and so I'm not interested. And I think instead, clearly Littlefield was right. And I think even for people who are older or even much older than the characters on the show, there was that ability to still identify, to say that, you know, that was once me. Or for younger fans, like we were talking about, to say, oh, maybe one day that will be me, that this is a kind of roadmap for them.
The people behind the show was part of the lure of the show was the fact that they were mining sort of their own lives, and they were not far removed from that age group in the first place. Was that part of the spell of the show?
I think so. Yeah, David Crane and Marta Kaufman were about 10 years older than the characters that they had created. So they were thinking about their own experiences living in New York, being part of a larger friend group. But at the same time, they were very cognizant that they were a bit too old to really know exactly what it was like to be 25 in 1994. And so they ended up hiring quite a few writers who were in that age group and tried to mine those experiences and ask the writers to draw on things that they had experienced or things that their friends in their private lives had experienced and try to make that into some of the adventures for the characters.
As someone like the rest of us who enjoyed the show, like you said you did, in doing this book and doing a deep dive into Friends, what was the biggest surprise that you uncovered in doing your research for this book?
I think for me it was more just a kind of change of perspective, you know, that Friends has become so omnipresent that it's almost easy to assume that it just kind of has always existed, or that it just emerged out of nothing. And so I think for me, getting to talk to the writers and understanding, A, just how incredibly hard they worked to make this show and to work on every single line and every bit of dialogue and every scene to make it as good as it possibly could be. And then also the ways in which the writers drew on their own experiences. So, you know, anything from a writer going into a store with his girlfriend and somehow being cajoled into buying a pair of leather pants that were way too expensive for him and that he would never wear. You know, just really minor workaday stuff that we might mention to a friend somehow gets turned into art and into this compelling story that people still enjoy and identify with just by this alchemical process that was happening in the writer's room.
One of the stories that I find absolutely fascinating and you share is the idea of the casting of the show, and in particular, what the network did when it came to Jennifer Aniston and another commitment she had.
Yeah, it was a really interesting story to learn about. So Jennifer Aniston had been already committed to a show on CBS called Muddling Through, and the show did not seem to be destined for greatness, but it hadn't been canceled by CBS, and NBC was really intent on having Jennifer Aniston for Friends and felt like the show wouldn't be as good as it could possibly be without her. And so they came up with this kind of ingenious plan where they had this cache of Danielle Steele adaptation TV movies that they hadn't run. And they realized that given that they could run them directly against the show muddling through, they could effectively kill the show, that it would attract much of the audience that CBS was hoping to get from muddling through, and that that would give them a kind of dastardly way to ensure that that Jennifer Aniston would be available for Friends. And luckily for NBC, it actually worked.
Now, was CBS aware of this plot, and were they just defenseless as to what they could do about it?
You know, it was hard for me to tell. My sense was that CBS was in part not canceling Muddling Through to mess with NBC, knowing that NBC had Friends as a kind of centerpiece of its fall strategy. I'm not sure whether they were aware of the kind of counterplot, but I think by that point it was probably too late to really do anything about it.
Any other interesting tidbits about the casting of the other five?
Well, one of the interesting things was that initially the idea was that they were going to make Monica, the character of Monica, the centerpiece of the show, that she would be the star, and the other characters would be relegated to relative supporting roles. And they had initially pictured her to still be a chef and still be living in New York, but to be a little bit more of like a tough-talking, gruff but lovable figure. And what they had in mind was someone more along the lines of Janine Garofalo. And they actually reached out to Janine Garofalo and offered her the role. And Garofalo ultimately decided to take a job in the cast of Saturday Night Live instead. So it's fascinating to think about some of the other paths that the show could have headed in, depending on the specifics of the casting.
And is it true that they also wanted a seventh friend, an older friend?
Yeah, so, you know, in the same vein as what we were talking about earlier, NBC was really uncomfortable with the idea of having a show that was just about six people in their 20s and didn't offer any variety when it came to that demographic. And so after seeing the pilot, they had pushed David Crane and Marta Kaufman to consider adding some sort of older character, whether it was like a manager or owner at Central Perk, or someone else who would sort of be in the neighborhood that these characters could occasionally stop by and chat with and kind of glean their, you know, the wisdom of their age. And so some of the writers on the show referred to this character as Pat the Cop, naming him after someone they had known when they were in college who was sort of in the vicinity of their school. And so Crane and Kaufman sort of gave it the minimal amount of effort as they could to try to integrate this character. And then after a while, they went back to NBC and said, listen, this really isn't working and we really, really hate this. How about if instead of having this Pat the Cop character, we could include more about the characters, the six characters' parents, that we would make sure that their parents show up on a regular basis and we would get to know more about them. And NBC was willing to accept that compromise.
You mentioned earlier that there's a whole new generation of people who now watch the show in reruns, and it's still very popular. I mean, it was even a bidding war for it in streaming services. So I guess it kind of belies the question I'm about to ask. How well do you think the show holds up 25 years later?
I think it holds up quite well. I think that the craft that went into making it is visible in everything that we see. I think as well that Friends made some good decisions that boded well for its long-term health, including avoiding the kinds of topical or, you know, current events humor that a lot of shows lean on, where it's really funny at the moment, but for an audience 10 or 20 years down the road, they're just scratching their heads and saying, I don't even know what this is about. So I think in that sense, it's held up well. I think there are definitely aspects of the show that don't sit entirely well with me. I think the handling of Chandler's father is really transphobic and weird and poorly done. But I think that, you know, Friends is very, very lily white, and it's a depiction of New York that's almost entirely white. And I doubt that a version of Friends that was being made today would be able to or would want to be similar in that fashion. But I think outside, you know, those concerns are genuine. But I think notwithstanding those, the bulk of the show, I think, holds up quite well.
The book is called Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era. Saul, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Saul Austerlitz, author of Generation Friends, an inside look at the show that defined a television era. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com and check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0526, and you'll find links to Saul's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. Also, Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of our chat with Saul as a Patreon reward extra. Right at the end of our chat, you heard him talk about how the show dealt with gay characters and how the show was Lily White. Well, Saul and I went deeper into that discussion, plus we touched on other aspects of the Friends phenomenon. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Byron Brown, the anti-lawyer lawyer, plus 11-year-old actress Chloe Perrin, who has not one but two movies coming out. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, a show that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and also Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please, please, please feel free to leave a review of the show on the site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, two Oklahoma City police officers on routine patrol were hit by a car that ran a stop sign at a high rate of speed. Both needed hospital treatment. The offending driver, identified as 20-year-old Janisha Harris, admitted that she was fleeing another crash and didn't stop to check on the other driver because she didn't have her driver's license with her. Investigators found that she never had a driver's license in the state and that the plate on her 2013 Hyundai Sonata was actually registered to a 2011 Buick. Harris had her 17-year-old sister and 2-month-old nephew in the car with her. She was arrested, charged with child endangerment, driving without a license, failure to stop for a stop sign, leaving the scene of an accident, and various other infractions. Okay, 17-year-old sister and 2-month-old nephew in the car, no license, and fleeing the scene of an accident. All the way around, there are some questionable family values being displayed here. Yeah. Many of you listening to this may be parents, and all of you at one point were children. No matter which end of the parent-child dynamic you've experienced, let's hope it was nothing compared to this one. A 17-year-old girl stole money from her parents so that she could hire a person to murder them. Alicia Michelle Hatcher was arrested on 2 counts of criminal solicitation for murder. The teenager told detectives that she stole a debit card from her mother and withdrew $1,400 in cash from her parents' bank account. She also said that she paid a friend $400 to murder her parents. The friend failed to kill the pair, and Hatcher then paid $900 to a second person for the assassination. He also failed to commit the double murder. Wow. That's two people who are going to get bad Yelp reviews. Hatcher told police officers that she had used the remaining $100 to buy cocaine. The plot came to light when a student at a nearby school told an official about it. The teenager's boyfriend told detectives that she had wanted to kill her parents. Hatcher's stepfather is a police officer. Detectives said the teenager's motives for the alleged crime is unclear and that they have not decided whether to charge the girl as an adult. See, kids, let this be a life lesson to all of you. I'm sure her parents have told her in the past that if she wanted to do something right, she had to do it herself and not depend on others. Also, if she had paid attention in history class, she might have gotten a tip or two from Lizzie Borden. Which brings us to another edition of The Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
Remember those math quizzes you had to do in school, such as Train A traveling 40 miles an hour leaves Westford heading toward Eastford 260 miles away? 1 hour after Train A leaves Westford, Train B traveling 70 miles per hour leaves Eastford heading toward Westford? When do the two trains meet? Yeah, those were always nerve-wracking, but they weren't necessarily life-threatening. Now, if you're calculating how fast you can cross the train tracks in a Maserati before the train makes it to the crossing, you better get it right. But hey, this is the Darwin File, so what do you think? Officials say a man driving a sports car was killed while trying to beat a train at a railroad crossing. The crash between the Maserati and the Brightline passenger train occurred Thursday morning in Oakland Park, Florida. The train dragged the car several blocks before coming to a stop. Oakland Park Fire Rescue spokesman David Rafter says it appears the Maserati driver went around the guard gates to beat a freight train and didn't realize the Brightline train was approaching from the other direction. Look both ways, folks. Always look both ways. The car's driver was the only reported death, but a conductor on the train was taken to a nearby hospital. And as you know, folks, the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man in New Zealand was called into a work meeting and feared the worst. So he hired an emotional support clown to join him. For Joshua Jack, the suspicion he might lose his job was right. When his supervisor scheduled the meeting, he said he thought it was either a promotion or worse. I thought it best to bring in a professional, and so I paid $200 and hired a clown. By the time the meeting was over, Jack didn't have the job, but he did have two balloon animals, a unicorn and a poodle. The process to blow them up and shape them got rather noisy, he said, and the meeting attendees had to tell the clown to be quiet from time to time. The clown reportedly also mimed crying expressions as Jack went over the paperwork describing his termination. I'm beginning to understand why perhaps Joshua was being terminated in the first place. Wouldn't you love to be a supervisor in the meeting who presses the intercom to the secretary and bellows, "Miss Jones, send in the clown," and one actually walks in through the door? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? The United States, like most democracies, is a country ruled by laws, and like most democratic countries, some of those laws are just plain weird. Byron Brown is a trial attorney who is known as the anti-lawyer lawyer. He's on the line with us right now from Arizona to talk about some of the weirdest laws in the U.S. Hi, Byron.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I've got a list of 10 laws, and I don't think we're going to get to all of them, but... Because, quite frankly, some of them aren't exactly the weirdest of laws, but we do have time to get to some of them that are just downright strange. Starting with one in New Jersey. It is illegal to wear a bulletproof vest while committing murder. Are we burying the lead here?
Yeah, we are burying the lead. I mean, murder is against the law, so it seems kind of part and parcel that anything related to that
would be illegal, but they, I guess, don't want you to murder people with a bulletproof vest on. It just seems really backwards, right? Like, just focus on the murder. We don't want people murdering people absent wearing a bulletproof vest or otherwise. But yeah, if you commit a murder with a bulletproof vest on, you can catch some extra charges.
And isn't it, I don't know, how does a law like that even get on the books? Do you know?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of these laws that we see are really weird, either relate to one of two things. One, time, they just happened so long ago. Or number two, something happened that caused one of the legislatures to take kind of like a pet project and push it through, because this is the one I see in New Jersey. You know, something probably happened with someone getting murdered and the person who committed the crime was wearing a bulletproof vest, and that person had an in to the legislature and someone took it on as a pet project. Because obviously this, I don't ever really have heard of anybody murdering anybody with a bulletproof vest on. You hear, you know, unfortunately a lot of murders committed coast to coast in the United States, but you rarely hear the bulletproof vest. So that's what I think happened with this one.
And hypothetically, should someone commit a murder while wearing a bulletproof vest, how much more time are we considering tacking on to their what is already going to be a life sentence?
Well, and that's exactly it, right? I mean, whether they're going to run it consecutively, which they probably would, but it would be a felony, and it would carry upwards of 5 to 10 years in addition to the murder charge.
Now, again, burying the lead, in Tennessee, you can't duel anyone if you want to run for public office.
Yeah, and this is one of those ones where I was just talking about that took place likely decades, if not centuries ago, because no one duels nowadays that at least I'm aware of. So obviously someone ran for public office and was notorious for dueling at night, and someone didn't like that. And so they passed a law, at least in Tennessee, that if you want to run for public office, then you can't be out there dueling other people at the same time. It's kind of humorous.
Mm. In Oregon, and by the way, I'm going from 10 to down to one. The ones I've skipped was Indiana with number 9. It is illegal to sniff glue. I had assumed it would be illegal to sniff glue anywhere. Number 8 was Wisconsin makes it hard for margarine because they can only put margarine in restaurants if customers explicitly ask for it. Wisconsin is a dairy state. I can almost understand why that one exists. That doesn't seem that odd.
Yeah, Wisconsin's known for their cheese, right? And so they want to push the cheese. They don't want to be pushing the margarine. If you ask for margarine, the restaurants can serve it. But absent that, you can't freely offer up margarine in Wisconsin without committing a crime.
In the state of Oregon, hunting in cemeteries is illegal. My question is, Hunting for what?
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, this one makes a little bit more sense. You know, there's some of those older cemeteries that are within a forest. You can see a hunter, you know, following a deer or something and then shooting it and, you know, end up being on a cemetery. And if you had a loved one within that cemetery, that could bother you. So I think there's some logic behind this one. But again, you know, an obscure one, one you don't really hear about that often. But I would agree with you, it's probably not as weird as some of these other ones.
Although I would assume that if the animals were aware of this law, you know where they'd be gathering.
Yeah, just meet at the cemetery and all huddle up there, and then no one can shoot you.
And then I would assume at that point, if people who are going to visit their loved ones can't get around because of all the animals, I bet you that law would change in a hurry.
That's the thing, right? You kind of patch up one hole in the dam and then and two open. So yeah, you're 100% correct. This is one of those things where there's always going to be somebody upset.
Number 5, South Carolina prohibits minors from playing pinball. That, again, doesn't seem that unusual either. In most cases, children aren't even allowed in so-called arcades.
Right. You know, again, though, just the activity in and of itself seems a little weird. Out of all the things that, you know, the youth can do, playing pinball is one of the more innocuous ones that doesn't cause any harm, as opposed to some of the things that we see minors do nowadays that may be annoying to the general public. But again, you're right. Typically, they shouldn't be in those establishments. I think it was probably back in the day when people smoked in those establishments and even served alcohol. So it's one of the ones that's on the books. But, you know, most of the time now we think of arcades like Dave and Buster's, where, you know, the youth are out there and minors alike. But back in the day, this definitely made sense.
In the state of Washington, number four, it is illegal to kill Bigfoot.
Yeah, so someone in the legislature definitely was a conspiracy theorist, and they really had it out for people who wanted to go and hunt Bigfoot. I mean, maybe they also have a law against killing unicorns and other imaginary things. I, for one, don't believe Bigfoot exists. But if you do, then we can get in this whole debate about whether it's, you know, related to the bears and we kill bears. So, again, a very weird one, one that I can only explain with assuming someone was in the legislature that shared that conspiracy theory and wanted to protect the big feet.
Yeah. You see, I'm not into killing. However, since, as you say, we're not sure that Bigfoot exists, wouldn't someone take the chance of breaking that rule? Because if they killed a Bigfoot and brought its carcass back to civilization, that person is going down in history.
100%. And they probably are not aware that it's illegal to kill a Bigfoot. So if they do, maybe they just need to pull it from Washington and say they got it in Oregon or somewhere else, as long as it wasn't in the cemetery in Oregon.
There you go. Okay. Number three, in Louisiana, it is illegal to send a surprise pizza. Now, again, this is one that I find baffling, because I would assume for a law like this to be on the books, someone must have been annoyed by a surprise pizza.
100%. Someone was annoyed by a surprise pizza. They had a friend or themselves had it in with the legislature and they wanted to pass a law. You know, our tax dollars at use for absolutely the wrong thing. I mean, I love pizza. Someone wants to sell me a pizza, or sorry, deliver a pizza to my house, I will gladly pay for it. But obviously someone was doing this to annoy people, harass people and the like. And so they passed a law to prevent surprise pizzas. But it's so specific, right? So can you send surprise Chinese food, you know, or a surprise burger, because it's just related to pizza? So again, just a little weird.
Number two, in West Virginia, it is legal to take roadkill home for dinner. Again, the need to have to put this into law, to me, in West Virginia, that's just a given.
Yeah, but they've tied up a couple things, right? First, you got to give the proper authorities notices. Then you got to go and get a hunting tag within a certain amount of time as well before you're able to remove it. So, yeah, it's legal, but at the same time, you know, how many people are going to go, you know what, I'm going to go spend my money to get a tag. I'm going to go and tell the authorities. At this point, 48 hours has probably passed, if not more, and that roadkill probably isn't good for human consumption or really anything else at that particular time.
Mm. And number one comes from the state of Florida. We're not surprised. It is it is illegal for unmarried women to parachute on Sundays. There's so much to unpack in that one.
There is, but you're right. You know what? Florida is weird. If we're going to think of any state with a law like this, it's probably Florida. But you got to imagine someone wanted to marry a young lady and she wanted to parachute on Sundays, and that guy just got annoyed to the point that a law was passed preventing it. So if you're a single lady in Florida and you want to parachute on Sundays, then you got to get married.
Well, I'm trying to imagine the power of the person who has managed to get this ridiculous law on the books. Because, you know, for instance, this is not a law that goes back to the dawn of the Constitution, because it could only take place during the era of flight.
100%. But again, right, it's Florida. Like, we hear stuff out of there that happens in no other state in the country other than Florida.
Wow. That's impressive. Byron, we've got just about a minute. I got to ask why, because I mentioned in the introduction you are known as the anti-lawyer lawyer. Why is that? Although I can pretty well guess, because I've seen some of your commercials online, complete with your tattoos, but you explain.
Yeah, so I think typically when we think of a lawyer, we think of someone in a three-piece suit, maybe with a comb over, a pocket square, They think very highly of themselves. They speak down to people. They're a little too much arrogance about themselves. I'm the opposite of that. I'm usually in a tank top, shorts, hands, fingers, neck tattooed. I'm very approachable. I don't talk down to people. I'm straight to the point. And like I always say, I'm like that uncle or cousin that everybody probably has who's bald and with tattoos and, you know, you want to go and grab a beer and chicken wings with. I'm the blue collar lawyer. I'm straight to the point, no BS. And so I'm opposite of the other lawyers, hence the anti-lawyer lawyer.
Although you say you're very approachable, if I were to walk down the street and saw you coming the other way with your complete sleeves down to your fingers of tattoos, I'd question whether I'd need to cross the street or not.
Hey, I'm a giant teddy bear. I know I look a little intimidating, but at the end of the day, I am a giant teddy bear.
Byron, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you talk with us, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk again.
Yeah, I appreciate it as always. Thank you very much.
Byron Brown, the anti-lawyer lawyer. You can check out Byron's website at antilawyer.com. And while there, I urge you to go to the media section and check out some of his videos. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check the show number for this program, which is show number 0526, and you'll find links to his website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to 11-year-old actress Chloe Perrin. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But I got a few more Stuff File news stories that I want to share with you right here, right now. A commercial flight with 326 people on board was forced to make an emergency landing when hot coffee was accidentally spilled over the cockpit control panel over the Atlantic Ocean. The Airbus A330-243, flying to Cancun, Mexico from Frankfurt, landed at Shannon in Ireland. With the hot liquid causing a strong electrical burning smell and smoke rising from the panel, the captain decided to divert, the report from the Air Accidents Investigation Branch said. The incident happened after a pilot put his coffee cup without a lid on a tray table rather than in a cup holder. There was no injuries in the incident, which happened in February. The AAIB did not identify the airline, but said it had since changed procedures to ensure that cup lids are provided for flights on all routes, and that crews are reminded of the need to use them. Hey, I was always taught you shouldn't have beverages around computer terminals and in studios around audio boards. Why wouldn't pilots already know this? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, a Gwinnett County, Georgia medical examiner has resigned after wildly misinterpreting the cause of death for 61-year-old Ray Neal of Lawrenceville, who died on July 21st. Despite reports by police and witnesses of large amounts of blood on the floor and the walls at the scene, investigator Shannon Byers initially ruled Neil had died of natural causes. But when his body arrived at the funeral home, employees discovered a hole in his neck, and Neil was returned to the morgue for an autopsy, which revealed that he had been stabbed several times. Police are now investigating the death as a murder. Is this the current assessment of investigator Shannon Byers, or does she still believe that perhaps he was stabbed in the neck at the funeral home? By the way, does Byers have an alibi for the time period of the murder? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actress Chloe Perrin has been in several films. She was in Jurassic World with Chris Pratt, Buttons with Robert Redford, and she's had recurring roles in television shows such as ABC's Single Parents, CBS's Reckless, and the critically acclaimed women's wrestling series GLOW on Netflix. In October, she has not one, but two horror flicks coming out just in time for Halloween. One is Itsy Bitsy, and the other is called Mary, co-starring Oscar winner Gary Oldman, in which she plays the title character. And Chloe is only 11 years old. She joins us on the line right now from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Chloe.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
No problem.
Have you always wanted to be an actress?
Yes, I always have been.
How did you get started?
Well, my acting career started in Dallas at age 3 when I was cast in Ella in an industrial with the American Heart Association.
Wow. And obviously you enjoyed that experience because you continued doing it. Now, as I mentioned, you've got two new movies coming out. They're both horror movies. Are you someone who gets scared?
No, I'm not. I really love watching horror and thriller movies.
Wow. Because I got to tell you, I've seen the trailer for Mary, and it kind of creeps me out. So you like horror movies? Because if I'm not mistaken, these movies, at least Mary, is rated R. So you're not even allowed to see that without your parents, right?
Yeah, but they'll be coming with me anyways.
Okay. How did you enjoy making these movies?
I thought it was really fun because it's always interesting on the set of horror movies. Because you get to meet so many great actors, and everyone on set is just so nice. And it's really fun behind the scenes because you get to see how everything works. And it's not so scary once you see that.
Hmm, that's true. That's true. Now, what's the most fun part about being on a set for you?
The most fun part? I think meeting new people.
That's cool. One of the things I know that's very difficult sometimes when you're becoming an actor is you have to go about memorizing all your lines. What's that like for you? How do you memorize your dialogue?
Well, I actually draw pictures to memorize my dialogue. Like, I draw little stick figures doing actions for my lines.
Wow. You should be teaching an acting course. That's an interesting trick.
Thank you.
I hadn't heard that one before. Now, when you're working on something, because I mentioned before you were working in some television shows, you're working on shows like Single Parents. You had also done CBS's Reckless when it was still on the air. One of the things about those particular shows is they were shows that involved a lot of kids in most cases. Is it more fun when you're working on a set where there's a lot of people around your own age, or do you just like hanging out with the adults?
I like hanging out with both groups of people. Kids I can relate to, but I like adults too because they're funny.
Well, let's talk about the two films you've got coming out. First of all, Mary. And again, very impressive. You get to play the title character in this movie. Tell us what Mary is all about.
Mary's about, so this family, they buy a boat to start a business, and they fix it up because it's really old, and it turns out there's a ghost on the boat. And the ghost tries to turn us against each other and tries to capture us.
Wow. Now, I've seen the trailer for Mary, and in that trailer, You're not exactly the best little girl in the world. Was it fun to play those parts?
Yes, I love playing mischievous characters.
you say it with so much glee. You really seem to enjoy it. Now, you worked with Gary Oldman, who's an Academy Award-winning actor, who's in that film with you. What's it like meeting these actors, these really accomplished actors who've done so well in their career? And you're starring with them in a film, and you get to keep pace with them, and you get to work with them. What's that like for you?
It's amazing. Like, I never thought that I would be in a movie with someone so big as Gary Oldman. It's such a big honor. And I think that it's really exciting to work with someone as big as Gary Oldman.
Who do you like watching? Like, for instance, who is somebody that you say, wow, I have to at some point work with that person?
I don't really know. I like to work with everyone.
Cool. So the other movie I mentioned is Itsy Bitsy, and that title comes from the fact of the old nursery rhyme, Itsy Bitsy Spider. So tell us about that movie.
Okay, so a family moves into an old house because the mom is looking for work, and she gets a job nursing, and it turns out that there is a spider in the house, and the littlest girl, which is me, goes into the attic exploring, and she gets taken by the spider.
Ooh.
And the family has to try and rescue her from the spider and get out alive.
I got to say, you're a far more brave person than I am. I know when I was watching the trailer for both movies, I was looking through my fingers, so there you go. How do you go about picking the roles that you want to play? Do you read the script? Does your mom read the script? How do you decide, this is the movie I want to do?
We both read the script, and then we decide which roles are right for me and which roles that we don't want.
And if you were going to write your own script and star in your own movie, what kind of movie would you like to be in, and what kind of part would you like to play?
I'd probably write a horror movie, and I think I want to be the star.
So you really like horror, right?
Yes, they're super fun.
What is it about horror movies that is super fun for you?
Everything, really. It's really cool to see it all get pieced together on the big screen. There's so many elements that just bring it all together and make it super fun for me.
And I know, having been on some sets before, that there's a very long process in making a movie, making a television show. There's a lot of downtime, there's a lot of setup, there's a lot of repetition. How do you get past the, let's be honest, some of the more boring aspects of making a movie or a television show? How do you deal with that time?
I usually make friends with the other actors and talk with them.
Wow. So you've made a lot of friends over the years. Do you get to keep in contact with these people when the movie is done?
Yes, my mom gets their Facebook, and we get to talk with them.
Excellent. Now, is acting something you'd like to do all of your life? Is this your career forever, or is there something else you want to do?
Well, yes, I want to be a veterinarian when I grow up, but I also want to continue my acting career.
Well, there are ways you could actually might be able to combine the two. Maybe you can make documentaries about being a veterinarian.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting to do.
Chloe, it's been amazing having a chance to talk with you. Good luck with both of your movies coming out, Mary and Itsy Bitsy. Mary is going to have a release date on October the 11th, and then it's going to be in theaters and then on video on demand. And Itsy Bitsy had a limited theater run, and it came out on August 30th, and it will be available on DVD and Blu-ray after October 1st. Congratulations on all the work you've been doing, Chloe. What do you have coming up next? Do you know?
Well, I have more episodes of Single Parents coming up.
Ah, on ABC. That's a fun show.
Yep.
Well, Chloe, thank you.
I also have a web series called Charlie Tries coming up.
And what's that about?
It's about me playing a character named Charlie, and I'm going to be doing lots of comedy skits in it.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Chloe, for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It was really fun talking to you as well.
11-year-old actress Chloe Perrin. Again, her two horror flicks that you can catch are Mary, in which she plays the title character, and Itsy Bitsy, where she battles it out with a killer spider. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0526, and you'll find links to the trailers for both of those films. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
This story proves that just because you're brilliant doesn't mean you're smart. An unusual case of fraud was uncovered in Tokyo when 34-year-old Yusuke Taniguchi was arrested for having stolen the credit card information of over 1,300 people and used it to make purchases online. According to police, Taniguchi worked the register part-time at a mall in Kodo City. Whenever a customer would pay by credit card, the suspect allegedly memorized their 16-digit number, name, expiry date, and security code, all in the time it took to process their purchase. Wow, I can't even remember all of that on my own card, and I've had it for years. Using his photographic memory, he could retain all of the information until after the transaction, when he could then jot it down. Taniguchi would take the items he purchased online and sell them through a pawn shop for money to use on living expenses. Following Taniguchi's arrest, police found a notebook containing the hundreds of names and numbers and are currently linking them to past incidents to determine the scope of his alleged crimes. So, if he's such a criminal genius, how did he get caught? Apparently, he was too busy using his brain to memorize numbers to realize that providing his home address to deliver all his ill-gotten gains was a bad idea. So, why, oh why, would you, someone who clearly has intelligence, pull off what might just be the perfect crime only to be thwarted by having the stolen property delivered directly to your door? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0526. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0526. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing the show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.